Welcome to Bankless, where we explore the frontier of internet money and internet finance. This is how to get started, how to get better, and how to front run the opportunity. I'm Ryan Sean Adams. I'm here with David Hoffman, and we're here to help you become more bankless. David, we've got an OG on the podcast. OG from a founder perspective, also an OG protocol. This is Rune Christensen from MakerDAO. What did we cover? What were some of the highlights for you?
Yeah, this is actually, I think, two podcasts in one. So the first half of this show is all about a tweet thread that Arun put out that captured both your and mine attention. And it was a technical argument about why things will likely collapse down to one single ecosystem. And so where previously, like, maximalist arguments have generally been one of mostly emotion and people speaking their bags, Rune does a fantastic job of actually articulating a technical rationale for why there will likely only just be one layer one blockchain that will succeed, at least with regards to smart contract platforms that have DeFi on them. So he goes through the game theory about why DeFi apps might actually align themselves with one specific chain in lieu of...
I'm going to say it, David, because he said it. It's like an ETH maximalist take, right?
Sure, yeah. I mean, we also go through a section with Room about, like, well, we can strip away the names of these things and just talk about the concept of layer 1A, layer 1B, layer 1C. One has greater levels of adoption. One has minority levels of adoption. But yeah, if you want to add, like, names onto these things, like Rune is saying, well, for MakerDAO, putting MakerDAO first and being a MakerDAO maximalist, it actually game theoretically makes sense to commit to one chain and one chain only. And so Rune takes us through that argument, which I find personally, I find very compelling. And that's the first half of the show. Second half of the show, we go through Rune's recent proposal on the MakerDAO governance forums about making DAI, quote unquote, clean money and pointing MakerDAO's abilities of being a capital generation facility, a credit facility, towards things that combat climate change, and having MakerDAO being climate aligned and branding DAI as this clean money that when you use DAI, you are actually helping combat climate change down the line. And the mechanisms for that are simply allowing capital to be directed and MakerDAO to fund things like solar farms or sustainable energy farms or things that actually help us fight climate change. And this has been one of the big bull cases for crypto at large. Back in 2009, 10, 11, 12, we had no idea how this would actually get done, but we did understand that crypto can help coordinate against problems that are larger than nation states. And to this day, nation states continually to illustrate their lack of competency with being able to tackle problems that are bigger than themselves. And so it's very, very cool that we're seeing a DeFi app on Ethereum take up the mantle of being the thing, the coordinating body that can actually go after climate change, because like Rune says, so many people are just in denial about it or they've given up hope. Like he said in the show, it's gone from climate change denialism, as in just being blind about it, to climate change doomerism, saying, well, we know it's real, but like it's too late to do anything about it. And so it's optimistic. It's awesome to see something in the crypto world take the climate change problem head on. Or at least that's what Rune has proposed. And so we go through his proposal and all the details around that.
Yeah, absolutely. So Bankless listeners, this is like a two-part meal for you. I think the first meal is where we talk about why crypto will have a layer one power law winner and why Rune actually thinks that might be Ethereum and is probably going to be Ethereum, which is an interesting take. And the second course, I think, counteracts a lot of FUD that we've heard just in general, in the mainstream, let's call it, you know, maybe senators, politicians, regulators, and just like mainstream institutional news that crypto is bad for the environment. Well, Rune is proposing that Maker become good for the environment. Every time you buy DAI or own DAI, that is actually a plus one for reducing environmental externalities and helping climate change. So super fascinating conversations. Again, if you want to take this in two parts, that's probably a recommended way to digest it. These are all tied together though, David, in one way, which right. Is the future of Maker. What is the future of this OG DeFi protocol that's been with us since inception? And, you know, one, the answer seems to be Ethereum and layer twos. And the second seems to be this clean money narrative. At least that is what Rune is proposing. But what does he get to control? He's just another governor on the governance forums now that the Maker Foundation is decentralized. That's a fascinating conversation in and of itself. You are definitely going to enjoy this one with Rune Christensen. Before we get to the conversation, we want to thank the sponsors that made this episode possible.
Bankless is proud to be supported by Uniswap. Uniswap is a new paradigm in asset exchange infrastructure. Instead of a cumbersome order book system where trades are matched with other humans, Uniswap is an autonomous piece of software on Ethereum, which is what Ryan and I call a money robot. No human counterparties or centralized intermediaries, just autonomous code on Ethereum. Input the token you want to sell and receive the token you want to buy. Something brand new in the Uniswap ecosystem is the Uniswap Grants program is now accepting applications for grants. We have been saying this for a while and we'll say it again. DAOs have money and they are in need of labor. If you think that you have something to contribute to the Uniswap DAO, apply for a grant to Uniswap. Just look at the size of the Uniswap treasury. It's almost $3 billion. This mountain of capital is looking for labor. Do you have something of value to contribute to the Uniswap DAO? No matter how big or small your idea is, you can apply for a Uni grant at unigrants.org and help steer Uniswap in the direction that you think it should go. That's exactly what we did to get Uniswap to be a sponsor for Bankless, and you can do the same for your project. Thank you, Uniswap, for sponsoring Bankless. The era of proof of stake is upon us. Proof-of-stake systems like Ethereum, Terra, and Solana allow the industry to move away from the hot, loud, and wasteful proof-of-work systems and return back to a cottage industry of individual stakers and individual validators. And that is what we need to make this industry stay decentralized. Individuals must play their part in crypto network validation. And that is what Lido is here to do. Lido makes staking accessible to everyone at the click of a button. By delegating your stake to Lido's network of nodes, you can access the yield offered by proof-of-stake systems and claim your share of the network transaction rewards. Do you have 32 ETH and want to stake it to Ethereum, but running a node sounds intimidating? Or maybe you have less than 32 ETH and you need to pool your ETH with others so you can access staking yields. Lido offers a solution for both. Simply go to Lido.fi, choose which assets you want to stake, and deposit them to the Lido validating network. Lido is working to make sure proof of stake stays as decentralized as possible, and is committed to decentralizing its own validating network to eventually become a completely permissionless protocol. So if you want to stake your ETH, Terra, or Sol and get liquidity on your stake, go to Lido.fi to get started.
Bankless Nation, we are super excited to introduce you to our next guest. This is Rune Christensen. He is the founder of MakerDAO. He was building crypto before Ethereum was even a thing, and he started MakerDAO before DeFi was even a thing. MakerDAO has pioneered some of the most fundamental components of this industry, really the foundations of DeFi. When you think about a decentralized stablecoin, when you think about decentralized governance, when you think about DAOs, all of this started with MakerDAO back in 2016. It was actually my first love and my first fall down the DeFi rabbit hole as well. So we're going to unpack a lot of these topics with Rune. We're going to talk about some of his threads about layer one. We're also going to talk about the future of MakerDAO, how he sees it evolve into a green money type platform, a clean money type platform. There's so much to discuss on this episode. First, I just want to say, Rune, welcome to Bankless. You are an OG, sir. It's fantastic to have you.
Really glad to be here. Yeah, I think it's going to be exciting.
Okay, so I want to start with this question because, you know, you've been in crypto for a long time. I've been in crypto for a little bit. Some years in crypto feel exhausting, right? Some feel exhilarating. There are times in crypto I feel like super optimistic about the future and the direction we're headed. There's other times where I just feel like jaded. Like I'm done with it. Like this short-term thinking and, you know, chasing after scams is too much for me. I want to ask you, is that how you feel as well? Like, do you ebb and flow between these things? And how are you feeling about crypto and DeFi right now?
I think rather than sort of ebb and flow between it, I more like have both feelings simultaneously at all times, I guess is the best way to describe it. You know, it's like, I mean, it's like that bell curve meme, right? You really got all the extremes. You got so much of the most sort of inspiring and amazing stuff you'll ever see in your entire life, right? You'll just scroll through that on Twitter coming from some weird avatars. And then at the same time, yeah, there's like the dark side of crypto as well, right? It's like the good, all the good comes with also an incredible amount of bad and frustration and scams and, you know, what do you even call it? Incentivized stupidity and all of these things that really, you know, it's frustrating that that's how it is. But you know, over my many years in crypto and you know, my origin as a Bitcoin maximalist back in the really early days, I've just come to accept that that's just what it's like, basically. That's what this space is like. And you just have to sort of accept and live with that. And then, I guess, try to focus on the positives.
So you've come to peace with things, then, it sounds like. You've kind of reached this state of Zen where you can live with both of these realities simultaneously, and you don't let one get you down or the other get you, like, too excited. You're just, like, you know, focused on the future.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you absolutely need to be able to do that, too. I mean, work in a space, and I guess especially to build a project and try to really make something new, right? I mean, that's something that it's sort of I remember just some advice, some wisdom on that topic, right? It's from, I think it's from Kane from Synthetics that had this quote of something like, if you haven't been called a scam yet in crypto, you know, keep working hard. One day you'll make it, right? Because that's a part of it, right? That there's all, you know, that's the thing about where the negativity, the sort of the bad side of crypto follows the good side of crypto, and they're both fundamental and interconnected. And you have to be able to deal with it, or you'll just, it's just not for you, right? You shouldn't be give away your life force to something if you can't really handle it.
We absolutely close every single Bankless episode with this line. It's not for everyone, right? But thanks for joining us on the Bankless journey. And I totally echo that. Crypto is not for everyone. It's an emotional roller coaster out there, and things get absolutely crazy. But let's talk about something crazy that happened in a good way for Maker recently. You guys have been up to a lot of things this year, but something that more recently hit the headlines was Societe Generale, SG we'll call them, which is a massive French bank, a bank based in France. They just posted on MakerDAO's governance form, and apparently they want to inject $20 million in collateral in their bonds, you know, as part of the Maker collateral platform. And this is so interesting to me. I want to hear the details from you about kind of the specifics of what they're trying to do and why. But what's super interesting to me is we've actually reached the point where the banks are coming to DeFi. How crazy is that? But tell us about this. What are they doing here? Why is this meaningful? What is kind of the bond that they're proposing injecting as collateral to back DAI?
Yeah, I fully agree that the most sort of shocking part of it is this, like, what? Now the banks are coming to DeFi. It just seems like, it seems a little too early almost, a little surreal. But actually, for me, the thing that really was crazy about this is I had just no idea it was in the works at all. You know, so that's really the sort of showcasing, you know, a decentralized organization, right? So I was like, just super surprised to see it, and just like, what? I had to like Google it and be like, we're talking, is it a real bank? This thing, it's the third largest bank in France. I was like, you know, that was pretty mind blowing. So what's going on is that it's Societe Generale's hard to pronounce, but it's their blockchain subsidiary, a sort of experimental subsidiary that's doing this kind of DeFi blockchain fintech, you know, cutting edge innovation and experiments and trials with that kind of stuff. And so apparently last year they created a tokenized bond. So there's been this bond living in Ethereum for quite a long time already. That's basically, yeah, like some kind of real bond in a token format that's been done, I guess, under French law as an experiment, ultimately. And so now they've reached the point where they're starting to look at, okay, we've created this thing, you know, can we actually go and use it in DeFi? So I guess then they've been working together with some of the contributors, the decentralized contributors in Maker that are being paid by the protocol to support it. They've basically been working together with this Societe Generale's blockchain subsidiary to prepare this proposal to Maker. And Yeah. And one of the things that's also sort of another mind-blowing thing that also just really showcases the, you know, the incredible potential of DeFi and really this fundamental power of money Legos, right? Is that, so this token they made a year ago as an experiment, it's an ERC-20 token, and it just out of the box, it fits right into the standard maker collateral, interface essentially, right? So like, there's not even any technical work in all of this. There's like the work, the sort of the barriers that were necessary to overcome for this were, I guess, basically the legal work on the bank's side in order to figure out whether they could do this legally. And then the work of like writing the proposal. And that's it, basically, which is kind of crazy, I think. And then, of course, when it comes to the actual sort of the qualities of the collateral and how it's useful to Maker, I mean, then I think one thing a lot of people immediately notice is that this bond they have, so it's a euro-denominated bond with a 0% interest rate, basically. So it's basically like a bond it's like a 5-year bond, right? So it's not super liquid, but it doesn't actually pay an interest rate. And that's, of course, because in Europe, we've got some pretty serious negative interest rates going right now. So people will actually they're very happy to just get euro at 0%. But of course, that means that it's going to be hard to charge a high stability fee by Maker on this use when this bond is used as collateral. And I really think the role that this kind of asset can play, and also just generally this kind of collaboration between Maker and these very, very large institutions that are sort of sitting in squarely in traditional finance with all of the scale and sort of interconnectedness that entails, is really that they can provide liquidity to Maker, right? So it's a way to basically have some of the Maker and some of the DAI collateral in a form that is somewhat similar to the role that USDC is playing right now and Paxos stablecoin as well, where I see is like liquidity reserves that are sitting there ready to protect the peg and basically make DAI very liquid and very useful. But then this would be a way to sort of take some of that exposure and move it over to just like a completely different type of exposure, right? Instead of being to a stablecoin provider, it's with a huge bank and it's a different jurisdiction, right? It's French law. And I think that's quite desirable because, I mean, that's one of the biggest topics in Maker governance for, well, a very long time at this point is like, how do we diversify out of all of the USDC that's sitting there, right? So I think that's great. And that's a very clear sort of way that this has been a beneficial relationship that can be developed further. But I think the final thing that, you know, that's really what really matters of all of this is the precedent that it sets, right? I mean, one thing is the fact that you now have one of the world's largest banks and the third largest bank in France. They've gone through sort of the legal work of figuring out whether they can use their tokenized assets as collateral and Maker. And basically, they're saying it can be done, right? I mean, that's why they've gone so far and sort of staked their reputation on making this proposal, right? And that's really a huge deal. I mean, it actually sets obviously it's not a strong sort of legal precedent or anything like that it sets, right? It's not anything like there's been courts or law firms making legal opinions and publicly stating that this is legal or anything like that. But the thing is just, I mean, the way that the world works is when you have something like a huge institution, like a bank, they're part of the system, right? Like it really matters when a part of the system starts to sort of reorient itself. That's going to impact how easy it is for other parts of the system to do the same thing. And it really changes the landscape of which jurisdictions are friendly to DeFi. I mean, in particular, it makes France a lot more like a much safer place, basically. But I actually also think it impacts the entire EU. So I think that's a huge deal. And it means that it could be a lot easier for future interactions like this to happen. And maybe also not only would it have to be these kind of liquidity type of collateral assets, but you could also have financial institutions offering other kind of stuff for Maker to use as collateral, maybe stuff that actually provides, has the potential to provide real stability fees as well.
Rune, this isn't just some like lucky happenstance outcome because some bank chose to do some DeFi stuff. MakerDAO as an organization has had its sights on real world collateral for a long time now. And can you perhaps elaborate on the point as to why SG Bank chose MakerDAO instead of something like Compound or Aave or any of the other credit facilities in DeFi? What about MakerDAO, the organization there, was such a compelling place to submit a governance proposal for something like SG Bank? Why Maker?
So I mean, I don't know because I wasn't a part of the process, really, so I can only guess. But I think the one thing to really note is just like the sort of the age, the brand, sort of the history of Maker as being this sort of old conservative DeFi project, right? And then there's the fact that we've had this focus, we've had this sort of we've had a lot of communications and spend a lot of effort trying to educate and talk about the potential of DeFi interacting with the real world. So I guess on that sort of front, and sort of the when it comes to like who would a huge conservative bank choose as their partner when taking their first steps into DeFi, I think it makes sense that they would go for Maker, because that's exactly the kind of role that we've been setting ourselves up for many, many years at this point. But I think an even more sort of practical reason is because Maker is really the only place where you can go with something that pays 0% interest and still get people that are perfectly happy to accept that, right? Because we're sitting with so much USDC, where Maker is sort of the one place where risk really matters so much more than the return, essentially, right? So that's where a bank can really provide something that's useful, right? Like if they went to Compound and Aave, it wouldn't fit into the systems because there's just no place where people will park money to get 0% in return, right? That doesn't really work with their systems. I think that, it's also because of DAI's interconnectedness and sort of existence across DeFi, it's also just a way for them ultimately to tap into sort of the whole ecosystem, right? Because by tapping into DAI, they kind of actually end up tapping into activity across the whole space.
I think this is a massive step for DeFi, maybe one of the biggest markers of, I guess, institutional adoption of a DeFi protocol that I've seen. Like, I mean, it's a real world bank, one of the largest in the world, posting on Maker governance forms and submitting their collateral. Like, how crazy is that? How bizarre is that? Hard to imagine back in 2016, 2017, when you guys were first firing this whole thing up. So super cool step and really excited about it. Rune, want to hit on this next topic, which is super interesting to me. I came across a thread that you published, I guess, a couple weeks ago. I felt like this thread hit really hard. This was a Twitter thread. And I'm just going to maybe summarize a few points, and then we'll get into them one by one. But it was kind of a criticism of the multi-chain future, and also a criticism of the multi-sig future that a multi-chain future inevitably brings with its bridges. We're going to explain that a little bit more. But just some colorful language. You called multi-sigs a dumpster fire, right? Their use as bridges, at least, not in general, but their use as bridges from chain to chain. You also said, and this was very provocative, on a very long time scale, only one layer one can survive. Only one layer one can survive on a very long time scale. You didn't just tweet that. You actually had justification, like backing up why you think that might be the case. And then you also said, game theoretically, DeFi protocols that are on Ethereum, they probably won't support other chains. It's almost like this version of, let's call it ETH maximalism light. I know we're not talking about toxic maximalism, but DeFi protocols on Ethereum will want to have their home chain be the winner. So I want to dig into these topics, and maybe let's start with the first. Let's talk about multi-sigs, dumpster fire, duct tape. What is a multi-sig bridge? Can you define that for our listeners? And then why do you hate them so much?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly is a complicated topic, but actually I think the most important thing to really define first and that wasn't actually completely clear in the, you know, because of how these terms are used, right? But there's a multi-chain, and then I guess there's what I'm really talking about, which is multi L1. Because the distinction between like a chain and an L1, that's very significant, right? Because, and that's kind of the what I'm really talking about is L1s and what happens when you have multiple L1s. And basically it comes from this, the fundamental perspective that an L1 is essentially a blockchain that sort of goes out of its way to be independent and be, and actually sort of not interconnect elsewhere, right? So if you look at all the different L1s, they're, you know, in practice, they're called ETH killers, right? And that's basically because they're positioning themselves, you know, as alternatives to Ethereum rather than as something that's fundamentally built to synergize and to tap into Ethereum's network. Because, I mean, and I really would argue that in practice, like if you're just trying to make, if you just think coming from the perspective of, you know, I'm going to make a blockchain, I'm going to make enable DeFi, I'm going to make sort of a, you know, a block, you know, blockchain business, blockchain economic ecosystem and all these things, right? Like the number one thing you're always thinking about is like, if you're trying to optimize for a good blockchain, a good environment for people to build, the main thing people care about, which is why they're using DeFi and why they're using blockchain is you know, interconnected. Ness, essentially, right? Like this interoperability, right? This synergy, permissionless innovation, money Legos. This is kind of the entire value proposition, right? So so there has to be like a really compelling reason to sort of deliberately exclude that, which then becomes this sort of this L1 narrative, essentially, right? Which is this idea that you can be a self-sovereign, you know, dominant blockchain, essentially, that can have its own ecosystem. So it's already like, basically, you're already from the beginning, you're sort of defining these things as being separate, as being distinct and being in some form of competition. And it's then from that perspective that you can then draw this conclusion of like the multisigs and the multisig bridges. Because I mean, the basic idea is that, when, like, the reason why someone uses blockchain, well, it's because they want interoperability, but it's also because they want security, right? I mean, that's why they're not just going on some, you know, centralized, whatever, right? Like some centralized service, right? They're actually going and finding, you know, using a blockchain so they have control over their funds and they have, you know, they have sort of an understanding of what kind of risks they're exposed to. And even if a user isn't doing that explicitly, then instead what's happening is they're using a platform, which is actually even more sort of obsessed about what kind of risks is this platform, this, you know, this maybe this custodial solution, what kind of risks is it exposing its users to, right? So security always, like, it plays this fundamental role. And in particular, this, like, this sort of the task of, like, figuring out, you know, what kind of security are you expecting and what are the risks that you're willing to take and all of this stuff, right? And that's kind of where the problem comes in, because every single L1, they sort of offers their own perspective on this, right? So Ethereum, it's like, you know, you want the users to run the nodes, and you have all these, like, sort of this more, I guess, more pure approach towards decentralization, where instead, on the other hand, you have something like Solana, which is like, actually, you don't need all that. You can have an L1 that just does X, Y, and Z. And it's, to some extent, it's like users that use either, that sort of adopt either of those perspectives, they have very different expectations of what security means. Like, what is security, basically, and what is decentralization? And so that's why, basically, all bridges, in my opinion, ends up being multisigs. Actually, no matter how you construct them, you can pretty much think of them as multisigs, no matter what.
And Rune, real quick, when you're talking about a bridge, you're talking about, like, if I want to get my tokens, my DAI, let's say, from Ethereum to Solana, or from Ethereum to Avalanche, or from, you know, Polygon back to Ethereum, that's the bridge that you're talking about. It's transmitting from one L1 to another L1 through some sort of bridge, right?
Yeah. And actually, it's a little confusing because the terminology back in the day used to be that this was called a gateway. And then a bridge is when you do the kind of the swap. So you do an atomic swap cross-chain. But I guess now it's sort of, yeah, like a lot of other terms, it's become a lot more sort of abstract. And you just kind of, yeah. What I'm talking about are these transporting assets from one chain.
So go into that some more. Why do these bridges suck so much? And why do they become multi-sigs? And why do multi-sigs, you know, like create kind of a centralization vector that's duct tape, as you said?
Yeah. So it's basically that. I mean, I guess the best example is Ethereum and Solana. I think because that's kind of like, that's really the epitome of this whole sort of tension, right? We have Ethereum as sort of the incumbent, and then you have Solana as this very, very promising competitor that is providing its own complete ecosystem, right? And so the fundamental problem is that if you're transporting assets from, I mean, you can, and it's very concrete today how it works with Ethereum and Solana, right? Where basically the DAI that you move from Ethereum onto Solana becomes centralized effectively because the DAI doesn't actually leave Ethereum, right? Because DAI ultimately is tracked on Ethereum, right? So the DAI actually is sitting on Ethereum, but in a multisig, and that multisig then issues essentially an IOU on the Solana blockchain. And so what's happening is now you have, you know, you go from thinking of, you know, go from a security model of DAI just being this is, you know, DAI has the security of Ethereum, basically. And now, so one thing you're doing is you're moving it over to a new security model, which is the security of Solana, first of all, right? So you have to consider that. And then on top of that, and this is basically the problem in my opinion, right? You also have to deal with security issues of the bridge. And the security issues of the bridge are like pretty, they're just a lot more severe than the blockchains themselves. So for instance, like on Solana, maybe some would argue that Solana is less secure than Ethereum, but you still can't like, you know, you can't like lose your assets. So you can't like have a 51% attack on Solana that just straight up like steals your assets, right? The blockchain is built to prevent that, and it provides some guarantees that, I mean, the worst thing that can happen is something like censorship or double spending or something that's a bit less severe than straight up like losing your tokens. But unfortunately with a bridge, that's not the case. Like a bridge can it can just go and take all your tokens the moment it's compromised, right? And that's because it has to actually control the tokens as they sit on Ethereum when it's sort of providing them across a cross chain on Solana. And that's sort of it really is because you have these two L1s, they don't have like, they're deliberately built to not be compatible. And then you have to create some kind of system in between that then makes them compatible. And that system in between, it's actually kind of like its own block. You know, you can always think of it as its own blockchain in one way, but in practice, it makes even more sense to think of them as multisigs. And it doesn't matter what form they take. So actually, even if even when they actually are blockchains, that you can pretty much just think of them as like complicated multisigs, basically, because in practice, as a user, you're not gonna, you're not gonna sort of spend the effort of like actually figuring out the sort of the game theory and the crypto economic guarantees of some particular bridge. In reality, you have to basically, you know, think about who's actually holding these funds and are they going to steal them or not, right? And that's sort of the calculation you have to make before using a bridge.
And so what we're talking about with these, when you say multisigs for bankless users that are not familiar, right? These are kind of like, counts where it takes a certain number of individuals and their private keys to sign whether a transaction goes through or whether they can take your funds or not. So common multisig is like 5 of 7 individuals all agree to a particular transaction and, you know, that's it, right? So imagine taking your DAI, moving it through a multisig type bridge, putting it on some other chain, say Solana or something like that, and it's a 5 of 7 multisig bridge. That means it only takes 5 people who are probably friends, know each other in real life, like to collude and take all of that DAI from you. That's essentially what you're saying.
Or receive regulatory pressure.
Yeah, exactly. That's what you're saying. And you're saying, Rune, that like that makes the weakest link like in your security chain that multi-sig every single time. And that's what happens when we get a multi-layer one universe, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think in practice, of course. So actually, I'm actually a big fan of multi-sigs as sort of solution. Actually, and that's kind of the thing that I mean, that's why I think it becomes so much about multi-sigs, because when you have this sort of situation where you have some unknown risk, you're bridging between sort of two different paradigms of security, it's too complicated for people to actually, like, you know, figure out how to measure the security and the risks. And the best option really is to have like a bunch of trusted actors, basically. And then just being like, yeah, I mean, I just have to basically trust these people not to steal the money. And then, and I'm not sure about the specifics with the bridge between Ethereum and Solana, for instance, but I would imagine that we're talking about like some of the top companies in the space, right? And there is this sort of intelligent design to it, right? Like there's diversification, there might be jurisdictional diversification. So there are a whole bunch of optimizations that are made on this kind of construct. But the problem is just that in the end, it's never going to be as, you know, it's never going to be as safe as sort of native security. And it creates this weird dynamic, right? Where something like USDC, like centralized stablecoins, for instance, they're completely unaffected by this, right? They actually don't even need to use these centralized bridges. They just straight up sort of create their own centralized alternatives, essentially, right? And that's because they're just fundamentally centralized, so they completely sidestep all of these issues. But basically, for something like DAI, it really undermines the value proposition in the first place, because the point of it is that it's a system that actually runs based on the security of Ethereum, not based on sort of the trust you place in the individuals that are active day to day or anything like that, right? But then now you're sort of reimposing that kind of downside to it, right? By using it through a multisig. And ultimately that just means that you can't really compete with someone who's like, you can't be an outsider on an L1 essentially, and then compete with someone who's a local, because like as decentralized projects, right? Because you're decentralized project that has become centralized essentially, and then you're trying to compete with a local that is just decentralized and that follows exactly only the security model of this home chain that you're trying to compete for users on. And ultimately that creates sort of this game theoretic outcome where a project like Maker is just better off not even trying to compete on Solana. Or at least it's a difficult decision to make, because you're ultimately going to be at a disadvantage. And going there and trying to actually sort of boost the activity there by growing your own market share, you're always going to have that inherent sort of disadvantage. But then what you're actually doing is you're growing the home chain of your own competitor, in a sense. And that ultimately can lead to the situation where like Solana as a whole could like become a threat to Ethereum, essentially. And then I talked about this in the tweet thread as well, right? In the worst case scenario, if Solana, for instance, just became too big, right? If it became the real sort of ETH killer and really just like supplanted Ethereum as the main blockchain and sort of the hub for all of DeFi, then it would not be viable anymore to be an outsider of this ecosystem, right? You'd have to be natively there, because that's where the marketplace is, that's where the users are, and they're going to demand decentralization sooner or later, right? Whether it's directly as end users or whether it's the big platforms that decide what they're going to integrate under the hood. And theoretically, Maker would have to undergo some kind of migration, which is not even really, I mean, maybe that's not even really realistic, but then the alternative is something like, you know, wither out and basically, get outcompeted as Ethereum gets outcompeted by Solana, right? And so that's ultimately what creates this incentive for Maker to, instead of trying to, you know, instead of trying to benefit ETH killers that are basically undermining the thing that Maker needs to survive, basically, which is a strong Ethereum ecosystem, a strong sort of home field advantage, right? Maker is way better off you know, supporting L2, right? And trying to build out the Ethereum ecosystem, because that's where Maker has this sort of home field advantage, right? And then it's going to be the, you know, it's going to be the other projects that are going to have to eventually go through this kind of, you know, painful L1 migration potentially, right? If it turns out that that in the long run, it'll only, you know, it'll be Ethereum that ends up winning sort of the, winning out in the, what do you call it? The power law distribution of which L1s are going to see activity.
Rune, I want to summarize the thought process so far, just to make sure that I've got this right. And hopefully for the listeners as well. At the beginning of this show, we talked about why SG Bank might have chosen Maker, and it was because of Maker's risk aversion, right? One thing that Maker has done very, very well is optimize for risk and controlled risk. And then same thing with the Ethereum blockchain itself, right? Ethereum is supposed to be maximally decentralized. We encourage people to run nodes. We try and do our best to make running a node as easy as possible. And for the Ethereum L1 client developers, for the last like 3-4 years of their lives, have just like ground out client optimizations in the name of decentralization. And so when you say like, okay, cool, we have Maker, which is this very risk controlled application on top of this very secure decentralized blockchain, if we want to export our DAI, which is Maker's product, to the rest of the crypto ecosystem, all the L1s, we can do that. But then instead of all of this effort that Maker and Ethereum have put into controlling risk, all that just goes out the window once you put DAI into a multi-sig to port that over to Solana, because all that security, like Ryan said, it's the weakest link. And as soon as you have a 5 of 7 multi-sig, that's like, well, Ethereum might as well have just had 7 nodes, and all of this like client optimizations for the Ethereum blockchain have just gone out the window, as did all the risk control that MakerDAO does. And so what you suggested then next is like, well, we can just build a native clone of MakerDAO on Solana and not have to do any of the bridges. We can just have two Makers and they'll be the same entity, just one will be on Solana and one will be on Ethereum. But the problem you said with that is that, well, then that actually increases the adoption of the non-home field advantage chain, right? This alternative L1. And then there might be a time that because of the actual deployment of MakerDAO onto these other chains, you actually bootstrap that chain into its success. And then we have a messy outcome where the actual home field where Maker started with is now the minority chain. And now there's this whole mess where you have to migrate from minority chain to this new L1 chain. And that's true for not just Maker, but for all of DeFi. And so what you're saying is that it's actually game theoretically rational for Maker to just pick one place and optimize for that one place and make sure that the home base, the home field advantage for Maker stays as strong as possible. So Maker doesn't have to deal with this whole, which L1 do we call home? How do we optimize for like making sure we pick all the same L1s as everyone else? Is all of that correct?
Yeah. I mean, one thing I want to add, and again, it's a very complex set of interactions. But one thing to mention is you're talking about this like deploying an alternative to Maker on Solana, for instance, right? And actually, this concept of like the copy, mm-hmm. Already there, actually, you can't even really do that, because the problem is that you just cannot sort of bridge decentralized governance, right? Or rather, if you bridge decentralized governance, or any kind of bridge, any kind of decentralization, the level of security you end up with is the security of the bridge. So you can't have like two separate Maker instances that are not beholden to the bridge, essentially, unless they actually truly are separate, meaning they have completely different sets of governance tokens. And then they actually just become competitors. I believe. I mean, I don't think anyone's run those kind of experiments, but I think in practice, I mean, they're just not, you know, they're just gonna, it's basically gonna be equivalent to sort of just creating a competition in that sense, right?
And because they no longer have economic alignment.
Right.
Yeah, right. Like you get misaligned economic incentives. Yeah, exactly, right.
You spin up an identical twin, but it's your evil identical twin.
Yeah, I mean,
it turns on you later.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and that's also the thing about all of this is that we're talking about like looking really far into the future, right? So in the short run, none of this stuff really applies. It doesn't really have sort of short-term consequences. But, you know, that's the thing about Maker and me, I guess, is we're kind of obsessed about the very long term. And that's really mostly what we care about. And it's from that perspective, basically, that, I mean, my argument is essentially that you're just going to be better off trying to, yeah, like, you know, try to pick the L1 that wins and stick to that, I believe, because if you pick sort of the wrong one, you're not going to have a good time, you know, changing your mind later if another one ends up being the winner. And there is absolutely this possibility that, I mean, there is this vision of like the multi-chain future. That's what it's called, right? The multi-chain future. That's sort of the phrase that describes this, like what right now I think is actually the main belief of most people, right? That you will have all these various L1s and DeFi and sort of the ecosystem will just interoperate across all of this. And that's kind of what I call the multi-sig dumpster fire, because then basically what that world would actually look like is you would just have this endless sort of complexity of like where, you know, what's actually the trust assumptions of all these things. And yeah, I mean, yeah, it's actually like, if you sort of start to really dive into it, it's actually really hard to even figure out what does it actually converge to? And sort of my conclusion is, in the end, you just always end up with everything converging to sort of the one place where everybody agrees, okay, this is what we trust. Like, this is the common ground. This is where we sort of, when we interoperate with something, we interoperate it under these conditions, because we don't want to do it with, you know, interoperate under conditions that we don't, you know, with security, sort of a security setup that we don't understand, because, yeah, I mean, you need to, in the long run, in the short run in DeFi, nobody really cares much about security, right? It's more the degen spirit that sort of rules everything. But in the long run, it's the opposite. You know, the degen spirit can only take you so far, right? And then you have to actually really start to worry about risks. And that's when I think it'll just, you know, it'll set in this sort of requirement that, yeah, probably my guess is it'll be Ethereum, but of course I'm completely biased. That's kind of the thing, right? That I'm already locked in at this point because I'm exposed to Maker, right? I'm you know, financially and emotionally, basically, I'm fully invested in Maker. And that just means that my own interests requires Ethereum to win. So it's impossible for me to, you know, it's very hard for me to you know, not sort of double down on that that belief, right? But that's kind of the point, right? That the place where people will be mostly invested and where people have the most exposure or the most desire to sort of see succeed, that's what's going to be the standard in the long run of like how apps interoperate.
What's so interesting about this, from my perspective, Rune, is like I've never pegged you previously as any kind of maximalist, in particular an Ethereum maximalist. And what was interesting about your thread is it was more sort of a game theoretic case on like playing out on the long time horizon what's going to happen. And you're basically saying that all DeFi protocols that are Ethereum based will protect their home world, right? Will protect Ethereum and will want to work to make Ethereum succeed. Because if they move to any other chain, then, you know, essentially they compromise security and they will lose like to local competitors, is what you're saying. So that's one implication. Another implication is on the long time scale, as you said, only one L1 can survive. And I think what you meant is like, not that there won't be other L1s, but that there will be a clear power law winner. Say somebody with like 70%, 80% of the value capture and the market share and the mind share behind this. And this is interesting as well, number three, because I think this doesn't just apply to Maker, of course. This applies to all Ethereum DeFi protocols, whether they state it or not. And what I really appreciated about this thread is like, you actually came out and said it, right? It's like what everyone in the room is kind of maybe thinking or theorizing, you actually said it. Where I feel like some other DeFi protocols are kind of taking a wait and see perspective, and maybe they have plans behind the scenes, but you know, they're not really executing them. That's another, I guess, takeaway for me. Number four, I guess the last takeaway is, of course, none of this applies when we're talking about Ethereum layer two, right? So when we talk about a multi-chain future, I think a lot of people mean what you said they mean, which is like all of these different layer ones kind of interacting in some way, right? Another definition of a multi-chain future is we have essentially it's all in kind of the Ethereum ecosystem, but it's a whole bunch of different layer twos that aren't in any conflict with Ethereum. And they have a different bridge, right? Their bridge is not, you know, 5 of 7 multisig bridge. Their bridge is based on the underlying security of Ethereum. So ZK rollups and optimistic rollups take this approach. They have very sturdy bridges that don't compromise on security. So those are some of the takeaways in my mind from this thread and why I found it so insightful. Anything to add to that?
Yeah, so I think one, another sort of factor that I haven't really mentioned, but that also plays a huge part in all of this, is the role of the native token as collateral in DeFi. I would actually disagree that this applies to all or most DeFi apps. Like this concept of sort of, what do you even call it? Like incentivized maximalism or something like that. Right? So I think that's, in fact, most of the apps kind of because many of them don't, much of what people are using today and what's coming out today, it's not so focused on like security or decentralization necessarily, right? A lot of it is kind of it's sort of closer to, you know, it's more about building these sort of high risk, high reward things. And in that situation, you know, it really makes perfect sense to sort of be all over the place, right? Be super fast, cutting edge, not worry too much about bridges or anything like that, right? But I think in particular, you know, like it's really when you get to sort of the type of role and sort of the type of product that Maker is providing, right? Where we're talking about this like maximal stability, maximum security, maximum conservatism. And that's also where we then get into the concept of the native token, because the native token just plays such a huge role in this, in sort of the ability to create decentralized stability, basically. In fact,
are you talking about the native token of the layer one, or are you talking about like the native token of Maker or some other DeFi protocol?
Yeah, sorry. So to clarify, yeah, I'm talking about ETH, right? So the native token of the layer one, like so, and because I mean that's why everybody wants to be an L1, right? It's because a native L1 token is just so much more. It's the single most valuable thing that's ever been invented in blockchain, right? And you even have it's so valuable that you even have Bitcoin that has sort of let's call it a terrible business model, right? It's like a system that's just losing money, basically. Yet just the sort of the native token characteristics of Bitcoin makes it insanely valuable, right? And then you have Ethereum, which is like, you know, not only do you have this potential for very powerful, unit economics almost, right? Like a very powerful sort of just basic economic framework where there's profits, there's surplus, and it actually goes to the holders of the token. You have that, and you combine that with sort of this native, you know, self-sovereignty of also powering and running the network itself. You really get something that is just incredibly, incredibly valuable, first of all, and liquid, secondly, right? And then finally, secure and decentralized, which is the whole point of it. And that's the thing that is actually also so incredibly sort of interconnected with all of this stuff, right? I mean, one thing is that Maker is sort of on the Ethereum blockchain and it's on the home chain and so on, right? And sort of this is what the kind of security that our users expect and all of that stuff. But the other thing is like in practice, Maker just cannot really actually migrate away from Ethereum because it has so much ETH sort of backing all the DAI that you can't, you know, the act of sort of DeFi migrating away from Ethereum is going to have implications for the price of Ethereum, of the ETH token, basically. And sort of the act of like Maker migrating away from Ethereum could sort of, like that could just itself, you know, impact the stability of DAI, basically. And this might actually be the biggest factor of all, basically, and because it's sort of the hidden, the sort of the invisible hand that runs crypto communities and really runs sort of all of crypto, right? Is that the fact that, you know, Ethereum is a huge deal, there's so much innovation because first of all, it's super open to people to come and build stuff. And then everyone's actually got sort of a, you know, they're actually vested, they have a sort of vested stake, right? Everyone's holding ETH. So they're not only like benefiting from what they do directly. They're sort of also benefiting from being a part of the whole, that where everyone's contributing towards this with these aligned incentives, right? And it's kind of this, the same factor as well that there's this play here. And I mean, and so, you know, and that's it. It bridges once again our problem here, because you just like Solana is an amazing blockchain, I think, right? It's like super advanced technology, and it's like a very clever trade-off, I think. So I'm actually and that's why I'm a weird, let's call it a very weird ETH maximalist, right? Because I really think that Solana is a very strong sort of contender and a very, yeah, like a strong blockchain and so on, right? And I like, if you look at the Sol token, it's an amazing token, I think, to use as collateral, for the exact same reason why Ethereum is an amazing token to use as collateral. But try to move it across a bridge, and suddenly it's really not that appealing anymore. That's basically the problem, right? So it's not so easy for Maker it's just not that attractive for Maker to like stock up on let's say Sol tokens as collateral backing DAI. Like you could have some, sure, but like you're not gonna feel good having like a huge portion of the collateral portfolio of a decentralized stablecoin be basically a blockchain token that's held in some kind of, I mean, either it's a multisig or it's some kind of very complicated technological machinery, right? That where ultimately there's all sorts of risks that you can't really, like, you can't directly analyze them game theoretically. You have to just basically put your faith in it, right? And so in the end, you can just think of it as basically like a multisig of a bunch of factors that you hope all are going to work out. But basically, if they go wrong and you can't really, you can never know exactly how and why that would happen, then you could just lose the assets entirely, right?
And importantly, that's just not true about Ether when Maker is on the Ethereum chain, right? Ether, the properties of Ether as collateral inside of MakerDAO hold a lot more monetary premium due to its nativity and its nativity to all the other DeFi apps that are on Ethereum. Unlike the Sol, maybe there is a monetary premium behind the Sol token, but the value of that monetary premium is just thrown out the window when you establish a bridge.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that like a Maker clone, I'm not sure if there's, yeah, there is a Maker clone on Solana, but it works a little bit differently, works based on derivatives. But I think just like a system that just generates a stablecoin by accumulating huge amount of Sol tokens natively on Solana, that's a strong model, I think. But I don't exactly see a stablecoin on Solana, you know, sort of carrying across huge amounts of ETH through the bridge onto Solana to then have a bunch of centralized ETH IOUs sitting in a decentralized stablecoin over there, right?
So, Rune, does this mean all these chains fight to the death? Is that how it's going to play out?
I would say that Ethereum, you know, I mean, I said this, you know, what is it, in 2015 or something, I made this like original Reddit comment about synergy synergy in blockchains and later, you know, it ended up becoming, you know, it was called DeFi and Money Legos and all of that, right? But basically, I think that Ethereum just has this completely unstoppable momentum already. So like in practice, it's just already it already is the standard, essentially. It's growing so fast. So like, I don't think necessarily that other blockchains will sort of fizzle out necessarily. But I think we've seen it happen with something like EOS, for instance. Whether it will happen to, like, whether it's a possible outcome for Solana, I don't know if that's the case. Like, Solana might have hit critical mass where it's going to grow from its where it is now. But the question is it ever going to actually be something that can sort of surpass Ethereum and be the new standard that Ethereum is today? I guess it actually comes down to the L2s, right? So that the optimistic rollups and like, you know, Starknet and CK Sync and these things that are coming, like if they get adopted, I think it's game over in the sense that, you know, you'll never, it's just, you know, the window of opportunity for Solana to surpass Ethereum is sort of right now, basically, right? We would have to see sort of migrations of applications from Ethereum over to Solana. We would have to see sort of the cutting edge of innovation happening on Solana rather than Ethereum. And sort of an, a kind of an irreversible trend towards that, you know, needs to occur before the roll-ups sort of, you know, start to develop a critical mass of being able to properly tap into the liquidity on the Ethereum mainnet and then having the, you know, user experience and all these things. And yeah, like I think, I mean, yeah, so it's not about fighting to the death. It's more like fighting to see who gets to sort of really, you know, bank the unbanked. Or that's a weird analogy, but like who gets to really sort of blockchain the whole world, right? Like what's, you know, so, and I mean, and maybe Société Générale, that's sort of the, it's a good example of that, right? I mean, the question is, so now they did it and there'll be another, you know, 100 banks doing the same thing soon enough. And the question is, are they all going to go to Ethereum or is it actually going to happen that, you know, that over time the center of gravity will be on Solana, for instance, and you would actually see this sort of large scale global adoption happen with Solana instead?
Previously, and also generally, the maximalism arguments have kind of been like emotional ones or subjective ones. But Rune, my take on this is that this is actually more of a technical argument as to for maximalism, right? And we can actually even just ignore the names of these systems, right? We can ignore the fact that one of these things is called Ethereum. We can ignore the fact that one of these things is called Solana. And we can have the same exact conversation just saying like L1A, L1-2, because bridges are agnostic constructions, blockchains are agnostic constructions, but the patterns being described here as when you compromise security going from blockchain A to blockchain B is the same. Do you agree that this is actually just like a more technical argument as to why one L1 will quote unquote rule them all, regardless of what that L1 actually is?
Yeah, I think so. And the thing is where I'm coming from, I mean, you sort of mentioned this a little bit earlier, right? That I'm just not someone who's sort of has traditionally been an ETH maximalist. In fact, I've sort of been the opposite. So I've always been sort of advocating for the multi-chain future but I've always had this. I mean, and the reason why I've arrived at these conclusions, which by the way are my personal opinions, and it really doesn't reflect what other people in contributing in the Maker ecosystem thinks. It's very diverse, I guess. But it happened because I was spending so much time trying to figure out how do we get our arms around this multi-chain future, right? How do we become the stablecoin that's, you know, sitting on Ethereum, but it's actually available everywhere, right? You don't have to worry about which L1 will still be available, you know, with native security. And then the problem was basically, turns out you just can't, the native security thing, you just can't really do that. I mean, you can do some, and you know, there's this whole side argument where some people will come in and then they will start talking about like Cosmos, for instance, or some other, like basically these like very advanced bridges, right? But, and the argument goes something like, what's going to happen in the future is that everything will be sort of multi-chain and, you know, like users will be completely fine bridging across one blockchain to another because when they bridge, they're using Cosmos. So they know, you know, the bridge has this sort of native security. They're very comfortable using Cosmos because they trust that and they're used to that. But actually what they're basically doing is they're kind of engaging in the same kind of L1 warfare in a sense, right? Because they're just trying to argue that Cosmos should be the L1. That's basically how I see a lot of this stuff happening. I mean, and then you actually see this stuff all over the place. And this is, I also wrote that in the Twitter thread, right? This is what I call a multi-chain propaganda, right? Because you really want to kind of adopt this, like, you know, we're working to, I mean, yeah, right? Just, this is this S-curve of platforms, right? Like in the beginning, a platform wants to collaborate, you know, with sort of the things that build on top of it, right? So at first, yeah, right, an L1 will want to not present itself as like an L1, but rather as a whatever, L whatever, anything else than an L1, basically. But in the end, I mean, I'm, you know, if Cosmos is running all these bridges all over the place, they're going to have, you know, they're going to have some they're going to provide their high level security by paying people, right? Like there's going to be costs related to providing that security. And that's actually what it all comes down to. It's like, who gets paid for like providing the ultimate security? Like the thing that's sort of like, when I get this stamp of approval, I know I trust it, and I know everyone else also trusts it, so that we can interoperate. And who gets sort of that premium of like being that final stamp of approval, right? And today that's Ethereum, right? So that's, and that's the ETH token, and that's what's making the ETH token so valuable, and that's what's making it so great collateral and so on, right? And in the future, it could be that it's actually not, you know, it could be that it's like Cosmos or something like that, right? Or Solana, whatever it is. But the point is that I don't believe that there's going to be more than one of these ultimate stamp of approval systems, basically, because it just, I mean, it's just not going to be as efficient to have multiple pieces of them. And it may work in this form of like, it's all bridges and so on, but they're actually all Cosmos and everyone trusts Cosmos and everyone's paying Cosmos. But yeah, like that brings us back to L2 and Ethereum, right? Because that's exactly what Ethereum is basically doing with rollups in the first place, right? That you can actually have a multi-chain future that is decentralized, as long as everyone's sort of making sure that they're getting the stamp of approval of the Ethereum chain, which is right now the de facto sort of, you know, truth machine.
Rune, let me ask you, this might be sort of a chink in the armor of your argument. I'm wondering what your reaction is to this. So I read a tweet recently that said basically, people who keep harping that whatever is not decentralized enough are just blinded by ideology, right? And the tweet goes on to say, what people really want is open money plus monetary incentive plus community. You don't need decentralization for that, is what this person said. You said earlier in our conversation that for assets like USDC, it really doesn't matter whether it's Ethereum or Avalanche or Solana or name your other L1 chain. Why? Because ultimately, it settles back in a Coinbase and Circle bank account, right? It's outside, it's a foreign citizen to the DeFi community, right? So it really doesn't matter for those assets. What would you say to that reaction that, hey, basically, decentralization doesn't matter as much as you think it does, Rune? And, you know, people are just here for kind of the open money, the permissionlessness, and this kind of whole incentive compatible community layer that we have.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with it, that most people don't care about decentralization, and most cases it's not actually needed. The thing is just that ultimately decentralization, that's what a blockchain provides. So you know, you don't actually, if you want to provide a future of open money and open all this stuff, and you don't care about decentralization, you don't need a blockchain to provide that, right? I mean, like a perfect example is something like FTX, right? That's a really cool example of like, this is where you have a regular company just doing all sorts of crazy financial innovation, right? And that's what actually really hooks people, right? Like they've got a huge user base. They're incredibly successful, right? And I think that's exactly because they're sort of tapping into that concept of, right, of like people just want cool financial tools to access. You know, so much. I mean, we were talking about sort of the good and the bad of blockchain, right? I mean, the reality is that almost everything that's happening in blockchain right now, like there's this massive sort of it's a hurricane of like, you know, basically projects and tokenomics that ultimately aren't sustainable, right? Like so much of the activity happening in blockchain today are like people getting yields from like yield farming or something like that, right? Ultimately, that it just fundamentally, the reason why it's happening is because it's like the Wild West and we're on the frontier and all these things are happening today that they're possible because, I mean, they were enabled by decentralization, but they don't really need it. They just need sort of enough of it and enough of a head start to not get like shut down, for instance, right? And over time, it's not gonna last forever, basically. Like probably a good analogy is something like we're before the dot-com bubble still, right? We're still in this sort of era where things just haven't really converged. And I think in the longer term, there's going to be this kind of pressure where on one hand you have basically, the decentralized networks and sort of the legitimate activity that's happening in fully decentralized systems that are, like DeFi stuff, like, where Maker is trying to, improve finance through better, through smart contracts that just create better financial primitives and these sort of really solid use cases. And then sort of all the way on the other end, you just have like straight up like Ponzi schemes. And basically the Ponzi schemes, what they're really going to be running up from in the long run is like regulation, right? And people suing them or whatever is going to happen to them, right? And the way they protect themselves is ultimately with like anonymity and decentralization. And you can kind of compromise on decentralization as well when it comes to creating scams or Ponzi's or whatever. But over time, there's going to be, I think there's going to be a limit to that. And you're really going to see that a lot of the kind of this middle ground activity we see today is going to kind of bifurcate into sort of just regulated stuff that's centralized and then, decentralized stuff that is either not regulated at all because it's completely cut off from the physical world, or that is regulated in a way where it's sort of the pieces that interact with the real world that get regulated.
Rune, one part of your tweet thread, which you hinted at a second ago, which I want to touch on before we close out this section and move on to clean money, is the whole Trojan horse multi-chain propaganda part of your tweet thread. My interpretation of this is that if you're a new chain with like lesser adoption, you're like a minority chain, and there's a chain out there that's bigger than you, you are game theoretically incentivized to say, oh, it's a multi-chain world, there's many chains and we're one of them, come do your things on our chain because we're part of this multi-chain world. And that's rational for a chain with lesser adoption to promote that sort of narrative towards, the greater conversation. But then if you're a chain with a greater level of adoption, you have an incentive to say it's a winner-take-all environment. It's a power law distribution. We are in the lead. We are going to stay in the lead. We're going to consume everything. And I think what you're implying is that, like, if you are a lesser chain, you want to promote this multi-chain narrative until you have sufficient adoption that you actually become the dominant chain, and then you swap, and then you say, well, no, it's actually a winner-take-all environment, and then you rug pull the narrative and say, now that we've gotten all the adoption that we have, like, turns out it's actually a power law distribution. And you were also saying that, like, things ultimately collapse down towards that final stamp of approval, right? The strongest stamp of settlement assurances that a blockchain can provide. And those assurances get stronger and stronger and stronger with greater and greater network effects. And so going back to like the last comment I brought up is like, is this kind of a logical conclusion of L1s, right? Like L1s all collapse down towards a maximalist tendency or network effects or to whichever one can create that the strongest settlement guarantees, the strongest stamp of approval. Ultimately, the game theory of all these competing chains collapse down to who has the best stamp of approval. Is that like the simplest way we can like collapse all of the things we've been saying is like, well, it's ultimately the game is who has the strongest stamp.
I think you can argue that to some extent. There's just so many factors involved in all of this, right? One example I wanted to make is that you can also think of it as like when you have this sort of, this lesser chain, right? Like a new chain with sort of less security, essentially, right? That's not considered it doesn't have that sort of final industry standard stamp of approval characteristic yet. As a result, you don't really care so much about what's coming through the bridge. Maybe today is a little bit different, right? But I think early on with Solana, especially, you could be able to be like, well, Solana itself pretty much looks like a multisig, right? There's a bunch of big nodes and all that, So what's the difference between going through the actual multisig bridge and then just like being on the native security of Solana? There maybe isn't that much of a compromise in the beginning. And that's basically the thing you could really say, right? That when you're sort of the underdog and you're transporting from, stuff from other chains, you just don't really mind because you're basically, you're trying to cultivate you're trying to bootstrap a different kind of community that's just more, have higher risk tolerance anyway, essentially, right? And then, yeah, once you're the incumbent, it becomes the exact opposite. You kind of want to, you're the incumbent, so you really want to emphasize that being, you know, being the I mean, that's exactly what's the case with Ethereum today, right? We all hold ETH, everyone's in Ethereum, hold ETH, right? It's so freaking important to be ultra secure, right? Like, security is the most important thing in the world. And you know, like, this sort of diamond level security, it really makes sense that that is just so freaking important, right? But I think if all your exposure is to some new L1, then it's just not, you know, you're not going to have the same mindset until, you know, your own interests align with that, basically. And yeah, it all comes down to the bridges, right? Because the bridges are kind of, they just fundamentally, they will always have a different, like, they always mean adopting an inferior security model, basically. And once you're used to an environment of very high levels of security, that suddenly becomes a bad thing, right? And yeah, I just really think that you would, you know, over time, you would absolutely expect to see that on Solana, for instance, users will prefer, when they're looking for something decentralized, they will prefer stuff that's native, because they will just not consider the bridge to be as decentralized as the stuff that's like truly native, following the real rules of Solana and being exposed to only Solana and exactly that.
A super fascinating discussion. I've not heard someone articulate it in quite that way. So, you know, thank you for that. And I think to distill this down, because this is partially a podcast about the future of Maker, right? And what you're saying is basically, you think the future of Maker is Ethereum and should remain Ethereum for the game theoretic reasons that you outlined.
Hey guys, hope you're enjoying the conversation with Rune Christensen thus far. Like we said in the beginning, in the second half of the show, we turn the conversation towards MakerDAO as a green machine and DAI becoming clean money, and both the rationale as to why MakerDAO needs to become a purpose-driven DAO, as Rune said in his blog post, and why that purpose should be climate change. So stay tuned for the second half of the show coming up next, but first, a moment to talk about some of these fantastic sponsors that make the show possible.
Gemini is the world's most trusted cryptocurrency exchange. I've been a customer of Gemini since I first got into crypto in 2017, and it's been my main exchange of choice to make my crypto buys and sells. Gemini is available in all 50 states and in over 50 countries worldwide, and on Gemini there are markets for over 30 various different crypto assets, including many of the hot DeFi tokens, and it's one of the few exchanges that has liquid DAI markets. Gemini just launched their Earn program, where you can earn up to 7.4% interest on 26 various crypto assets. If you're tired of paying fees in DeFi, or you don't want to worry about DeFi exploits, but you still want to earn interest on your crypto assets, Gemini Earn is the product for you. Another product I'm stoked to get my hands on is the Gemini CryptoBack credit card, which gives you 3% cash back on all of your purchases, but paid to you in your preferred crypto asset. When I get my Gemini credit card, I'm going to make sure that I get my cash back in ETH. So whenever I buy something, I get a little bit of ETH bonus back to me at the same time. You can open up a free account in under 3 minutes at gemini.com/gobankless. And if you trade more than $100 within the first 30 days after sign up, you'll be gifted a free $15 Bitcoin bonus. Check them out at gemini.com/gobankless. The Aave protocol is a decentralized liquidity protocol on Ethereum, which allows users to supply and borrow certain crypto assets. Aave version 2 has a ton of cool features that makes using the Aave protocol even more powerful. With Aave, you can leverage the full power of DeFi money Legos, yield, and composability all in one application. On Aave, there are a ton of assets that you can supply to the protocol in order to gain yield, and all of those same assets can also be borrowed from the protocol if you have supplied collateral. Here you can see me borrowing 200 USDC against my portfolio of a number of different DeFi tokens in ETH. I'll choose a variable interest rate because it's a lower rate than the stable interest rate option, but I could choose the stable interest rate option if I wanted to lock in that interest rate in permanently. V2 also features the ability for users to swap collateral without having to withdraw their assets, trade them on Uniswap, and then deposit them back into Aave. With Aave, users can do this in one seamless transaction, saving you time and gas costs. Check out the power of Aave at aave.com. That's A-A-V-E maker.com.
Let's talk about the next subject in the future of Maker. And this is a couple of days ago, you published a post in Maker Governance, because now that Maker is decentralized, I guess, Rune, you're just another guy in the Maker Governance forums, right? Just another guy posting. But you do have some clarity of vision and some great ways of articulating yourself. And you wrote this post called The Case for Clean Money. And this is basically the thesis or the idea that DAI should become clean money, that it should become greener over time, more environmentally friendly, in an ESG type of asset, if you will, or backed by ESG type assets. This was a statement I'll just pull out to kickstart this conversation, because we want to dig into this post some more. You said at somewhere near the beginning, to truly reach its potential, Maker needs to become a purpose-driven DAO. A purpose-driven DAO. Let's start with that, like, fundamental foundational thesis there. Why do you think that's true? Why does Maker need to become a purpose-driven DAO? Why can't it just go seek profits and make that kind of the short-term pursuit? What is it with the purpose-driven thing that is so important?
Yeah, so it's kind of a, you know, it's actually really exciting, you know, the world we're in now with DAOs evolving and human, you know, sort of new forms of human organization. And with Maker, like this proposal that I've made, ultimately as sort of, you know, basically as my opinion as an MKR holder, basically on how I can and sort of contribute and support the project as much as possible, which I do obviously hope, and I'm glad to see already it's getting some traction. But so there's a whole range of things that I've been thinking about basically the whole time I've been in the foundation, right, that have been sort of distilled out, and ultimately I came up with this concept of sort of, yeah, centering everything around this clean money vision. And this the question of, like, the DAOs, like how a DAO should organize, and this concept of a purpose-driven DAO versus, I guess, yeah, you could say like a profit-driven DAO, something like that. That's like a really age-old kind of issue and dilemma that we've been dealing with in Maker since actually the very beginning. And the very simplest way to think about it is just the fundamental game theoretic problems with DAOs are basically things like governance attacks, right? And sort of the tragedy of the commons, where you have this sort of shared public infrastructure, like project that you're using, and then you're counting on all sorts of individuals to coordinate around how to grow the thing as a whole, kind of in a way that benefits everyone, and you're worried about individuals, instead of doing stuff that benefits everyone, you're worried about them doing things that just benefits themselves disproportionately, right? And the most basic sort of example of this of all is like the governance attack, where you could have, in most DeFi protocols, if someone actually controlled the majority of the voting shares, they can just straight up like steal all the assets in that protocol. Maker actually has protections against that, so it's more like you can end up into this kind of a crypto economic death spiral, kind of, where what ends up happening is the protocol shuts down and everyone is settled out and has their funds returned. So people don't actually lose money, but you can have the whole protocol actually shut down as a result of a governance attack. So that was like, it was already clear from the beginning that there is this problem of like people have to participate honestly, and they have to kind of like, you know, there has to be this element of like basically the whole, right? That you're a part of a DAO and you're contributing a part, you know, as a group. And you have, I mean, and in the very, you know, the predecessor to DAOs, which was BitShares, that really invented these like very first, like DAOs basically called DEX back then. You really had this like this concept, like, you know, the community spirit of a DAO, right? And of like, you know, people held together by the token. And you even have that, like, I mean, even in Bitcoin, right? Bitcoin itself is driven by the same thing of like the maximalism, in a sense, right? Like the toxic maximalism is actually a kind of like a way for Bitcoiners to sort of, you know, work together towards a greater good, right? A greater sort of whole. It was clear to me that this is actually fundamental for DAOs to function, because the basic problem with everyone just being driven by money is just that you're just, you know, what if it's about making money, the problem is that's not a shared thing ultimately, right? It's all like making money is something that happens individual to you. So you're gonna cooperate with the group, you're gonna work together as long as that's how everyone makes the most money. But if you're ultimately there for the money and you're given an option to make more money for yourself at the cost of others, then if that's the only thing that drives you, that's actually what you're gonna choose to do. And yeah, so in Maker now we have this like very, very complex, very advanced governance process and even a governance bureaucracy that sits around this process with people that are actually being paid by the protocol and, you know, that are the full-time employees, right? Like getting money straight out of the protocol's revenue. And I think that's like for instance, being able to organize such a bureaucracy, it really starts looking like the kind of challenge that you have when you're just trying to create a, you know, like a startup, for instance, or a company, right? Where you really need, you need sort of a North Star. You need some way to really align people. And in a normal company, you can do that through, well, you can just have a, you know, centralized organization, right? You can have like a leader. In a DAO, it's not that simple, right? Like even if you have a leader, over time, that leader is going to disappear, right? The DAO is supposed to still function even without the leader. And that's why I think that really the best option then is basically to create a vision and a purpose that just actually makes sense to people, so that when individuals, they contribute to a DAO and in doing so sort of contribute to the greater good, right? Like the thing that inspires them to do that is they know everyone else is doing the same thing. And it's like, I'm not only like when I'm sort of honestly participating in governance and actually voting and considering what's best for everyone else, even though that is sort of an act of altruism. It helps myself, but it also helps everyone else. And to a large extent, it's everyone else that gets the most of the benefit. If you're doing that in an environment where you're helping everyone else make money and you're basically not really making money by doing that, and it's just about the money, then there's a mismatch of the incentives there and sort of the outcome. And instead, if you have a situation where there really is an actual sort of vision and purpose that everyone can follow, you're just going to have an easier time getting a critical mass in a community where people will actually collaborate rather than defect in the game, I guess you can say.
One point we always hammer on at Bankless is that this whole crypto revolution thing, the thing that it does the most is that it aligns human values with the market value of our assets. And that's kind of what I see with this proposal of saying like, hey, let's align MakerDAO with being green so that we can actually align more people under that shared banner, under that shared goal. And we'll come back to this subject towards the end of this conversation, because I do want to ask, like, is this the vision for MakerDAO that is actually putting MakerDAO first? Like, is this altruism, or is this actually just the most optimal strategy for MakerDAO growth? But before we get there, I want to unpack this whole green money approach first and foremost. And in your blog post, and again, when we started this conversation, we talked about Société Générale. You said the recent governance proposal by Société Générale, one of the world's largest banks, proves how Maker has the potential to impact the deepest layers of finance as a new financial backend. And so my question is that, are you saying that MakerDAO can actually influence the outcome of the real world by picking and choosing what collateral it accepts into its protocol?
I mean, that's the potential if it scales enough. It's hard to navigate just all the different complexities that exist in all this, right? But I actually think one point that maybe makes the most sense to focus on is this concept of, altruism versus sort of the greater good versus your own good, right? And because, you know, we're the thing about climate change is that it's just really, really serious. And it's like it's reached the point where it's so serious, it's so severe that you're really, you know, people are you know, it's sort of the story goes that people have sort of gone from you know, it used to be that sort of climate denialism was the big issue, right? That people like sort of just denying that it's happening. And now the big issue is sort of climate sort of doomerism, basically, right? That like it just seems impossible to deal with. So we just gotta give up and resign to our fate, kind of. And just, yeah, like ignore it in a sense. But yeah, like the problem is it's not, you know, it's not a good thing. And if you're someone like me that has kids, it really, you know, it's tough to accept, but the reality is that we're just in for some very hard times, basically. And that's where it kind of gets back to this, you know, the concept of the DAO as this sort of a bounded group of people that have to work together and you know, you wanna do what's best for yourself, but then the whole thing sort of falls apart because if everyone just does what's best for themselves, the DAO can't even function. You have to kind of reach this positive Nash equilibrium, right, where everyone works together and contributes their part and then it works. And yeah, we're in the same situation. You can think of the whole world basically as a DAO in that sense, right? That's right now failing horribly at choosing to collaborate, unfortunately. And yeah, so I mean, so from that perspective, the question is basically how can we as individuals change that? Because it's actually about like our lives. It's about like our homes, right, and our children, and the good news is that Maker uniquely is in a really interesting spot to be able to actually help with this kind of systemic change, right, and good example is that banks actually want to interact with Maker, right, so you have potentially a way to if the banks want to access cheap capital for Maker might be able to turn around and then ask for collateral that is environment, you know, that's sustainable, that doesn't have negative externalities. And Maker in turn, by virtue of being a decentralized currency, does have an ability to somewhat capture the value of preventing negative externalities and creating positive externalities, because it's basically the viral effect, like the viral potential of currency, basically, right? The sort of the network effects of liquidity and of sort of trust in currency are so incredibly powerful that, like, you know, promoting a currency on the basis of this currency is it's good for the world is actually very viable, because it just, that's actually what people would expect if you're asking to adopt some new currency. I mean, that's first of all, they don't care about money. You know, they really, it's the most boring thing they've ever heard. So it's like very hard to even get people to think about something like that. But then like if it's actually going to happen, then, you know, like the banks right now, you know, in the end, the way it works is who's offering, you know, 0.whatever% more in interest rates. Right. And they sort of all just follow the same fundamental paradigm, and in practice people don't change the banks, for instance, right? And I think that that's where you can, you know, you can come with a, that's exactly what DeFi has this potential, right, of like showing, look, this is a way for us to sort of realize that the whole world is in this, is actually this big interconnected, yeah, we can always think of it as like a big interconnected organization, right, where everything does ultimately have to work together, or we're all gonna destroy each other, because we'll negative externality each other to death, basically. And DeFi really, yeah, it can, you know, it provides a very powerful tool to try to change this, because first of all, you can program it into the money, right? You can provide the banks with cheaper capital if the people are willing to access currency that they consider to be clean money, right? If that means that you get more adoption, then you can turn around and you can use that to actually affect the change in the system, which then leads to even more adoption. And that's kind of on the, I guess, the branding and marketing side of this, right? And that's a way where it's a very unique way that you can use DeFi to actually like capture some of the value that, you know, some of the positive externality that normally would only go to everyone else. And as a result, you have a, you know, nobody's got an incentive to do it. But in this case, there's like, you can basically say, look, we can use this value to try to bootstrap a world currency, basically. And yeah, then there's like all these sort of other, like there's these sort of knock-on effects on how it, you know, how it can actually make a difference, right? So there's also the fact that not only can Maker sort of try to affect more sustainability through how it allocates its capital, but then there's also this concept of climate alpha, basically, where the current financial system basically has to sort of ignore what's going to happen with climate change. It's really, really bad. It's like, you know, what's happening is like worse than the absolute worst case scenarios that were predicted, right? So we're like sort of off the scale bad, basically. And the problem is
why do they have to ignore it, Rune? Why do you think the traditional...
It's because if you start pricing in climate alpha and if you start sort of making the calculations of how much does it cost to sort of pull the CO2 out of the air again that the fossil fuel, you know, the fossil fuel companies are creating now, and like the math of like how the global economy works, it basically doesn't check out. So like you know what's happening is people are then just not even making the calculation at all, right? They're just focusing on the short term, and this system is sort of finding all these creative ways to kick the can down the road. And really, the number one thing that's really happening is basically people are assuming that there's going to be this kind of silver bullet that will emerge, basically. So the silver bullet is sort of the way that it's being explained away, because, yeah, and often it's called the technological solution or something like that. And arguably, the reason why this is happening and the reason why people accept this and the financial markets accept this, even when we're talking about, like, you know, it's basically ignoring huge risks and sort of betting your money on the wrong horse, basically, because the implications of accepting that those risks exist just means that you can sort of, the whole thing can come crashing down, right? But I think that the reason why the concept of the silver bullet of the technological solution is so appealing is because we're so used to this kind of exponential, exponential innovation that happens in when it comes to digital technology, right? So things like Moore's law and how crazy, you know, the iPhone is now compared to whatever, right? And the internet and all this sort of virtual stuff that's just like, you know, every year it's just a new, you know, blockchain itself, maybe the best example ever, right? Of just like how you just have these complete paradigm shifts. But the reason why it's like, it's so severe and happening like that is because we're talking about, technology that relates to information ultimately, right? So it's not bounded by physics, but we've really become used to these kind of massive transformations and yeah, climate alpha or sort of the reality of climate change is that's not possible in the physical world. Unfortunately, you don't get these like complete exponential transformations. It's very sort of incremental what's possible to do.
Right. Because climate change is not digital. It is physical. And what you're saying is like these paradigm shifts, these 0-to-1 moments, they've all been in the digital world. And you're saying people are used to having these 0-to-1 moments, but forgetting that like these 0-to-1 moments that we've all been happening in like our digital devices, our digital lives, our digital internet. And so what you're saying, Rune, with this climate alpha is that the market is just not pricing in appropriately the future, the negative future of that we have with climate change. And I'm kind of reminded of our episode with Kathy Wood, who talks about like one of the reason why ARK Invest has done so well is because she has priced in components of the future that so many of the legacy institutions of the world have completely forgot about. So what you're saying is like there is a certain amount of alpha that's out there and available, and no one's capturing it, because if banks or financial institutions actually started to price in risk associated with climate change, well, they would actually be like at a net loss in profitability. They actually wouldn't be able to sustain themselves, and therefore the global economy wouldn't be able to sustain themselves. And so everyone is just ignoring the costs of climate change in order to make sure the economy actually works. And I think what you're saying is that leaves an arbitrage opportunity for MakerDAO to lead with assets and financial opportunities that do answer towards climate change. Is that all right?
Yeah, and I think you can really compare it to the financial crisis, right? Where it just, you know, nobody wants to look into sort of the mortgage-backed securities and all this stuff that's happening. While this, they're making money, it all works. And the problem is, if they suddenly start looking into it, I mean, that it would be very uncomfortable, because they've got so much sort of, the system is just so stuck in the way it's running right now. And yeah, basically what I think is going to happen is that there are certain physical assets in certain locations, which are sort of very far north and very far south in areas that will be able to remain, remain very stable, even if the rest of the world starts to really unravel and become very unstable. And so it's particular land and sort of very, you know, physical things like food production is sort of very basic stuff in these places. It's just, you know, it's going to be really the most important thing in the future. And what I think that the role that DAI can really play in all of this is that when you have people, you know, let's say in near the equator, right, like that are probably going to, you know, they'll become climate refugees sooner or later. It's just not be possible to survive there, especially if you're sort of a regular person. A really important role that Maker can play is basically, so when people from these areas, they have to escape and they have to go to places that are, you know, that are actually climate resilient and that you could, that are still livable. The problem is all of their own assets, if they're all stuck, whether, you know, if they all build their assets and all their money and you know, maybe, you know, they barely have any money in the first place, right? There's going to be people that you know, because that's kind of the problem with climate change as well. It really affects, it's very unequal the way it affects people, right? But if they already don't have that much, and then the few assets that they do have sort of lose their value because now they're, you know, they have land in the place is now desert. I mean, that's a really big problem. They're not, because they're just not going to be able to sort of pay their way to escape that, right? And what DAI can really do is it can play this role of identifying the climate alpha before the system, you know, the rest of the system is able to, and actually allow people to in a way sort of protect themselves against this future, right? Because if you hold your, you know, if DAI is backed by assets that are very climate resilient, then you know, even if, you know, if you, as long as you hold your money in DAI, then even if you know, you lose everything else, at least you know you're going to have money that they'll accept in, you know, New Zealand or something, right? Which may be the place you want to get to. And I think that one of the things this can lead to then is a way for kind of, you know, just means that you can really equal the playing field a little bit between sort of regular people and the elite, right? That are going to be much less affected by climate change, among other reasons, because, I mean, what they do is they just build bunkers in New Zealand, right? That's sort of one of the big stories of climate change, right? And a regular person doesn't have the ability to build a bunker in New Zealand, but they should be able to at least hold money that is backed by agricultural and real estate assets in New Zealand or something like that, right? I think that's going to make a big difference.
So, Rune, let's get into the specifics of how DAI actually becomes clean. You said a number of different strategies, but I just want to actually kind of take it through the story of how this actually happens. So we have the Société Générale as an example, using MakerDAO as a facility to get access to capital. So how do we use that strategy to actually impact the future outcome of the rest of the financial system? It's like, do we accept like carbon credits as collateral? We have ESG collateral. Like, what are the actual prescriptive details as to how Maker actually generates clean dye.
I actually think that sort of the real end game is that, and this is basically the reality of climate change, right? Is that the whole world needs basically total war approach, right? So it's fundamentally the way that economies and businesses function is just that they have to start considering negative externalities when they do business. And I guess that means, ultimately like governments regulating them or something like that, right? But the way we can get in that direction is actually for, it could be something as simple as Maker providing different risk, like basically different terms, different cost of capital, different risk parameters based on also accounting for externalities, right? So not just the sort of the direct risk of an asset, but then also kind of the external risk that this asset produces for everything else. In practice, I mean, I think the Société Générale relationship, for instance, I wrote this in the post as well. Like, I think the place where that actually fits in is not necessarily, like, it's going to be a while before, Maker gets to boss them around, right? If it ever happens. So it's not like we can sort of, it's not an effective place to try to really have an impact, I think, in terms of certainly if Maker becomes another voice in sort of the growing momentum for climate action, that does actually create some tiny indirect sort of pressure on Société Générale and all the other banks to also start to really consider ESG, consider externalities and how they do business.
So what you're saying is that the legacy financial world is taking advantage of not having to answer towards its own externalities that it costs, and that leaves an opportunity for a Maker to do that. And so, like, maybe some scapegoat for carbon production. Let's say some car company comes, and this is a car company that has not committed to electric vehicles, and they're doing combustion engine only, and they're asking for $1 million loan. And then something like Tesla comes to MakerDAO, and they're also asking for $1 million loan. You're saying, like, MakerDAO could charge a stability fee for this carbon emitting company that's 10 times higher than the stability that they would charge for Tesla, which produces electric cars. And these numbers will be measured by the externalities that Maker governance attempts to measure and calculate. And that hopefully just tips the playing field towards capital being allocated towards companies that are doing things that are climate aligned. Is that the model?
So I guess that's the point, that, like, when it comes to working with the big institutional partners, there's no way to really impact them directly. But yeah, like, when it comes to sort of allocating a lot of the basically just a lot of the capital that's sitting in Maker, and I think in particular right now what's very sort of pressing is all the USDC, right? Then what I'm arguing for is that Maker takes a more, instead of today, where the collateral onboarding process is sort of, it's sort of reactive in a sense, right? So Maker receives all these applications and then somehow tries to prioritize them and somehow, like, figure out how to price the risk of every single one of them. And there's, I mean, first of all, it's very sort of chaotic and not very efficient to just consider sort of any type of proposal that's coming in. But this, another really big issue is just that, like, it's like Maker is right now sort of set up to have to try to figure out how to really be an expert on literally any subject, right? Like, to receive any type of proposal and then actually know how should I price this, which is not, I mean, either it's not, it's just gonna go really, really slowly, or even worse, Maker could jump into all sorts of deals that the community just doesn't understand. So what I'm, so one way to look at it is, this is just, we really just basically need to, like, narrow down what are the areas where Maker wants to kind of specialize and actually know what it's doing. And that's where I think that when it comes to picking that anyway, sort of, then you really should pick basically sustainability projects, like sustainable energy production. And I think primarily that's because that's kind of that really helps with the brand, right? Like, it's a very, you know, it's very powerful if you're able to say this, you know, money backed by clean energy. You can sort of show it, right? You can show people, look, what DeFi can do is it can build this huge windmill, right? All these, this wind farm with 10 windmills, right? That they were actually funded through a computer program, right? That is programmed to basically fund these kind of things, right? And I think that that's actually something that people will understand can, you know, can impact the global situation when it comes to climate, unlike something like paper straws, right? Which is sort of this corporate scam almost of like making people feel guilty, but also being like, yeah, this is not, you know, the world is ending and you're going to be sitting there sipping on a paper straw, right? And it's not going to do anything. I think like being able to sort of, you know, really showcase that ultimately it's just a coordination problem. And we need to figure out a way to coordinate, and we can do that through money, right? And
I was going to ask about that, Rune. So you know, narratives are so important in just for humanity, but also especially maybe in the crypto space right now, right? So nascent, right? And so ETH has developed this ultrasound money type narrative a bit more recently, right? So you're talking about DAI as ultra clean money and developing out that narrative. And my question is, do you think that will be a demand catalyst for DAI, right? You know, certainly good for the crypto industry writ large, which I want to actually ask next, but do you think just people will want to hold and spend DAI because it has a positive social impact and reduces, you know, negative environmental externalities?
Yeah, I mean, I just want to, like, first of all, I really agree that crypto has truly proven that attention and narrative and, you know, yeah, like the sort of, you know, well, there's this concept of the attention economy, right? It's like, this is what drives everything, especially sort of capitalism today, right? I mean, you have examples like, you know, GameStop or something, right? Showing that it's really, that's what really matters. And it, all over the place in crypto, right? You just see it again and again and again, that really it's the attention, it's sort of getting the focus attention that generates value in financial markets today, right? And so already there, I think it's somewhat like a proven model. You could actually think of like, I mean, arguably, I think Tesla's success and the fact they became the most you know, valuable company in the world, like so much of that was exactly that. It was exactly this, you know, it was the narrative of the altruism, or sort of the positive benefit to humanity that they create, right? More so than the fact that it combines with the business model itself, then that's a very compelling thing, right? I mean, that's the kind of story people want to hear right now, right? They want to hear some kind of realistic way that we can do this without having to sacrifice all sorts of stuff, right?
And we've actually seen this play out in our world as well. When NFTs took off, a lot of people heard about Ethereum for the first time, and a lot of people started like boycotting NFTs because Ethereum is under proof of work. And so we've actually already seen this impact our industry because people are decently motivated to align with their values. And there's a decent amount of people out there that have the values of not destroying this planet due to climate change. And in your post, you actually cited that like the same sort of reaction in 2008, we had a housing crisis due to the nature of the financial system, the black box nature. And as a result of that, there was Bitcoin was created. And like people talk about this relationship between like, well, there was this massive problem that this financial system created. And then the people of the world, as a reaction to that, created Bitcoin. We use that as a solution. We're actually also seeing that same thing in DeFi, where the current financial system is so closed, so gated, so unwelcoming, that DeFi has been a reaction towards that permissioned financial world. And one of the reasons why DeFi has been so successful is because people have been longing for something like DeFi for so long, as a reaction to how just closed and gated the traditional financial system is. And so I think there's room where if this is successful, the branding of DAI as clean money, the narrative of DAI as clean money can be successful as a reaction to the rest of the world just completely ignoring this whole climate change thing. Is that your take as well?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I have high hopes that that this is a way to really drive people into crypto that, you know, right now just don't see the point, because basically it's about money and money and money and money, and not everyone cares about that, right? And being able to show, look, you can do more than, can be about more than money, right? It doesn't have to be all yield farming and compounding interest and collateralizing something into a vault and then drawing, going through 300 different smart contracts to get the most crazy yield you've ever seen, right? Like, a lot of people, doesn't appeal to them. It's not relevant to them. But climate change is increasingly becoming sort of very relevant to a lot of people around the world. And I think there's some places where it's still sort of less so. And, I think America is sort of unique in that I don't think climate change is nearly as much on the agenda there as it is, you know, in other places. I mean, I'm from a country that's literally, it's just going to disappear, you know, like it's actually, it's going to go underwater, Denmark, which is kind of, you know, there's a big difference between, how much people, how close it is to people. But I remember seeing this recent study where basically some scientists went out and asked a bunch of young people what they think of climate change. And it was like more than half said the world is doomed, you know. So there's a lot of, and that's this sort of doomerism that's happening today, right? That is actually very, it's causing a lot of personal stress sort of to a lot of people, right? And what I'm really hoping is that we can basically use DeFi to sort of rally the people that today believe that we have to just give up, basically. We can't even do anything. We should go out there and we should tell them that, look, we do have this one thing called DeFi, which allows us to control some, you know, a little thing called money, which is actually like the thing that makes everything work and act, right? And is, you know, in some ways you could say it's the, you know, it's money, it's the way money flows around the economy. That's directly what's causing the coordination problem in the first place. What's kind of like something that's kind of built into the plan, I guess you can say, is a sort of a hedge as well, where we just don't, I mean, there's a good chance it's just not, you know, maybe people just don't care and it's just still too boring, you know, money and finance is too boring. People don't care. It doesn't even matter if it's clean, whatever it is, you know, they're too focused on whatever, their TikTok or something, right? And people just don't care. And if that's the case, the thing is, like, the less sort of climate action that's out there, let's say the less excitement and sort of the less adoption of Maker there is based on the climate message and this sort of rallying cry for climate solidarity, the greater climate alpha will be, right? So Maker can sort of get to benefit from both of the outcomes in a sense. Like, either Maker will grow significantly because it sort of manages to tap into this zeitgeist and bring, you know, thousands of people into blockchain. Maybe the whole world becomes powered by blockchain as the way to overcome the transition away from fossil fuels. Or the other option is that the world basically ends and Maker was very early to buy up all the, you know, the good assets, basically. It's unlikely, but you know, you could, it's possible to imagine a future where no other currency manages to really sort of hedge against just how bad things will get, and you will end up with like Maker as like this ultimate currency that just happens to be diversified across the places that remain as very stable economies.
This is very long-term thinking, sir. And I love that because it sort of fits the motif of Maker from the general direction. I mean, you know, two other things I love. One, this kind of flips the narrative, at least in the US. We've seen senators like Elizabeth Warren come out against cryptocurrency and say, it's energy intensive, it's wasteful, right? Well, now we have a flipping of the narrative, potentially. Ethereum transitioning to proof of stake, right? Also, projects like MakerDAO maybe putting a flag in the ground and saying, hey, we're going to be clean energy, right? This is going to be like ESG friendly, environmentally friendly currency. We also see projects like David talked to a project called KlimaDAO doing a little something on this too. And I feel like this totally disarms them and totally flips the narrative, right? among politicians and their support for the system. Rather than Bitcoin, proof of work, which they've seen for the last 10 years, we've got like an Ethereum system that consumes very little energy, almost nothing. And also, we are actively improving, you know, the climate in all of these various ways. So that's super exciting. The second thing that I think is kind of maybe unique to Ethereum culture right now, which I absolutely love, is I feel like very much Bitcoin culture is a bit more like that New Zealand bunker that you were talking about earlier, right? It's like, where's my Bitcoin citadel, right? I'm just going to buy up this citadel with all the Bitcoin I've hauled it that's gone to the moon, and I'm going to wait for the world to burn because it's going to burn. Whereas the Ethereum ethos is like, hey, we don't want the world to burn. We have these coordination tools and this coordination technology. We can be an active part of the solution of putting out the fires and make sure the world doesn't go to hell. Like that to me is incredibly important and something that I see in Ethereum culture, particularly the past few years, that is like completely a 180 difference than previous Bitcoin maximalist type culture. We don't want citadels. We want like solar punk cities. That's what we're aiming for. And I think that's awesome. So plus one on that, sir. And I hope other DeFi projects start to explore this area. I think it's fertile ground. Anything else you want to say on that? I've got one last question around your post. And this is in respect to new tokenomics for Maker that you also kind of proposed. We don't have time to get into all the details because I know that's a huge thing to unwrap. But you know, tie off anything else you want to say about clean money. And then give us a sneak peek, just some quick bullet points on what some of the new tokenomics behind Maker might look like in the maybe medium to future, the thing that you're proposing anyway.
Yeah, so, well, so, I mean, I'm a huge fan of like KlimaDAO and there's a whole range of extremely innovative like climate focused blockchain projects out there. That I think, it's kind of like, it's just happening that now they're really starting to pop up, which is probably related to basically the trajectory of the climate as we now sort of experience it. But I think that there's huge synergy between many of these different like climate aligned projects. And the best possible example is KlimaDAO and then sort of the clean money direction of Maker, because basically Maker is really like what I'm proposing is that Maker really focuses on sort of building out the infrastructure needed in sort of a decarbonized world, right? And what KlimaDAO is really focusing on is basically trying to sort of incentivize people to do that in a sense. So there's actually this really interesting synergy where the kind of assets and the kind of collateral that Maker would want to put money into in sort of creating clean money would be exactly the kind of assets that massively benefit from a higher carbon price in the carbon trading systems, which actually KlimaDAO is going to contribute towards. So yeah, I'm really excited about that project specifically because I just love the idea of putting like crazy tokenomics and then just putting them towards a good purpose. I feel like that's the way to do it basically. So I love that. And then also the fact that there are just, I mean, it's, I think it reveals something about, it actually goes all the way back to this sort of the coordination problem and this question of like, you know, focusing on yourself or working together and how when people are aligned around this kind of common goal, it's just very natural that you would have all these synergies would emerge from doing that, right? So I plan to just research a lot more on the various initiatives out there and try to figure out how Maker can really tap into and sort of collaborate with those projects, which is often the case with Maker, right? Because one thing we really can do is use other assets as collateral, for instance. And that's a very sort of obvious way to synergize. And yeah, like, I mean, yeah, that, I basically can't, I don't think I can really get too much into the tokenomics basically, because that's like its own crazy topic and we've been going on for what, like 2 hours now. So but the basic idea is that I don't, you know, buy and burn is like possibly the oldest tokenomics ever basically, and I think it has some like it just has a bunch of downsides. That one really obvious downside that I think is very bad is if the price of MKR is very high, it kind of like buy and burn will just waste money by sort of buying the top, right? Which is, I really dislike the specific characteristic, because like there's no, it's not even like a, you know, we're not even talking about something that's rational to do, but just looks bad to the market. We're talking about something that's straight up not very rational. It's just not a very good idea to be buying and burning tokens if the price is high, basically. But more importantly, it's just DeFi has really created this tremendous innovation. I just think that it's time for Maker to try to tap into that. And so I came up with a system where the idea is basically to incentivize people to lock up their MKR tokens for a very long time and then get an ability to directly borrow DAI at preferential terms from the system when they do this, which sort of would feel like a dividend type of cash flow, right? Where you're just getting cash continuously. But the difference is it's actually you're borrowing money from the system with your MKR. You're not actually getting that money. There's a lot of implications of that. But I think basically that's based on everything I've studied and learned from the DeFi ecosystem, this is like the most powerful tokenomics engine that is entirely set up to focus on basically long-term thinking and long-term community participation. And that's what I love about like tokenomics, right? Is that you can actually code economic interactions and monitor, you know, cash flows and have them directly affect human behavior, which I think is, you know, that's the kind of stuff we need to tap into if we're going to try to, you know, turn the ship around with regards to the global climate change and, you know, our broken financial systems and all of that, right? So I'm very excited to dive into that.
That is super cool. I think people forget that, you know, tokens and DeFi projects can actually change their token economics and actually can improve their token economics. And if listeners want to find out a bit more about what Rune is proposing on the governance forms, it's under the title Sagittarius, I believe. And you can check that out for yourself. But Rune, it's been a pleasure to have you. And we've really enjoyed this conversation. And we've covered so much. I know you're very clearly a deep thinker. You've got a lot of wisdom for us. You're a DeFi OG. So I want to kind of close with this question. What do you think of everything that's going on in DeFi and NFTs today? Do you have any hot takes for us? Do you have any advice for some of the early projects or the users? Just anything you would leave our listeners with?
I think that I've come around to this idea of the super cycle, right? That there is really is this, you know, we're seeing this more mainstream type of adoption into crypto. So I think it's like now is the time to really be in crypto, basically, and not ignore it. NFTs is something where, I mean, I just didn't get it. And I really, you know, I also didn't get all the modern DeFi and all the tokenomics and sort of all of these things. I was basically like the boomer that just, you know, didn't get it and sort of thought it was gonna fade away. But I think there's really been, you know, there's some fundamental value and some real sort of powerful potential that's being uncovered here. That, like, I don't think that the industry really knows exactly what it is yet. Once we figure that out, that's going to be kind of the dot-com bubble moment and sort of the post-dot-com bubble era will be basically when we sort of get the real understanding of what is it that actually makes NFTs valuable, for instance, and what is it that actually makes the, you know, tokenomics be beneficial to real projects rather than being sort of Ponzi schemes, right? It's just so incredibly complex and mind blowing what has occurred now you really need to study a lot and pay a lot of attention and be very critical, I think, to not fall into some sort of trap when inevitably there's a lot of a new bubble or whatever is going to happen next.
Absolutely. Well, Rune Christensen, we will end it there. It's been a pleasure to have you on Bankless. Thanks for joining us for this conversation.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, Bankless listeners, Rune's advice was get in now. I can echo that, whether that's just from an investment perspective, whether that's trying these DeFi protocols as we advocate every single time on Bankless, or whether that's maybe getting a job in crypto. Go join a DAO. Go see what's up. Go tap into a Discord channel. Some action items for you today. References from our conversation today. You can read Rune's Clean Money post. We'll include a link in the show notes. We were talking about that. Also, that hot thread on multi-sigs. We were talking about one layer one to rule them all. We'll include that thread in the show note. We'll also include the SG proposal to Maker in the governance forms. You can check out all of that. Of course, guys, none of this has been financial advice. It never is on Bankless. DeFi is risky. ETH is risky. Bitcoin is risky. This whole thing is risky. You could lose what you put in, but we are headed west. This is the frontier. It's not for everyone, but thanks for joining us on the Bankless journey.